Good afternoon, everyone. We might get started. I know that we've run a little bit late out of the prior session, and I think my one mission in life this afternoon is to get you out of here on time at 3 o'clock. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Dee McGrath. I run the consulting and services business for IBM for Australia and New Zealand, and I have the pleasure of being here to facilitate this session on innovation and the workplace. I'd first like to start by thanking the organisers and the conference host, the Melbourne Institute, and of course the Australian. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of this session, the Office of the Chief Economist in the Department of Industry, Innovation and Science. I spent most of my career has been in financial services and consulting and technology. I work with large-scale enterprises. I work with the commercial sector, not-for-profit, and, of course, government-owned entities. And in that capacity, I work with our teams and our clients every day on how they transform their business, how they remain productive, how they compete on both a local and a global stage. And so it's a very topical subject around, you know, productivity and having a really strong economy and a strong industry, strong sector growth. We have three great speakers lined up for you today. So apart from making sure that we remain on time, you know, it'd be great if we make this a strong interactive session. We're going to have our three speakers come up and do a short presentation, and then at the end we will open up for some Q&A. So I would like to start off by introducing Mr. Mark Cully. He's the Chief Economist, Department of Industry, Innovation and Science. Mark has had a varied career in applied economic research at the intersection of government and academia. In 1995, he was appointed the Head of Research on Employment Relations for the UK government, where he ran the world's largest survey of working life. Mark is a member of the CEDA Council on Economic Policy. Mark, I'll ask you to come up. Thank you.
All right, that's a post-lunch session on the last day. Thank everyone for coming along and getting through this one. Let me start by saying how much our department values the relationship we've had over many years with the Melbourne Institute. The Institute is an adornment to Australia's economic discourse and research has been that way for a long time, and I hope it continues to do so for many more years to come. I've also enjoyed getting to know Abigail Payne, who's taken over as a director in the last year. We were happy to sponsor this session, and let me say, it's not. I don't intend this to be an advertorial, so I'm not going to waffle on about government policy on innovation and what have you. I'm going to give you some evidence from work we've been doing. So let me begin by saying that I really want to reiterate and emphasise Peter Harris's remarks in the opening session yesterday, that what we should be caring about is productivity and growth in productivity. Innovation is not an end in itself. Innovation is the stuff which is fundamentally which drives productivity growth and therefore improvements over time in our living standards. So what I'm going to do is showcase a bunch of work that we've published in the last couple of years, and in some cases is work in progress that will be coming out this year. And it's novel for Australia, at least, in that it uses micro data on all Australian businesses. I'll go on and talk a little bit about how that's been compiled and what we've done with it, but I'm going to give you some examples which show you the association between different ways of innovation and business performance. But first of all, I'm going to start with some macro material. I was talking with somebody over dinner last night, and they say, why does everybody compare Australia to the United States? So let me try to say that at least the reason why I'm doing it is I just want you to think about the United States as the world's leading advanced economy and as being kind of representative in some sense of being at the technological or global frontier when it comes to productivity. Now, that's not true for all of the industries in the United States, but if we just say as a kind of thought experiment, let's just compare how Australia compares with the United States, with the United States as a kind of representative of that frontier. And what you see here, which is this is similar to some of the charts that we did see yesterday, is that there's been, since the unbroken period of economic growth that we've had going back for 25 years or 26 years now, since 1991, and you can think about two different measures of living standards, and there's all sorts of problems with using these as living standards, but GDP per capita as one, and hourly earnings as the other, you'll see that Australia's outgrown the United States since 1991. That's partly a product of the fact that the United States had two recessions, one at the start of the 2000s when the dot-com boom came to an end, and then obviously the global financial crisis. The second point that I want you to draw out of this graph is that it's a little bit deceptive, but the two grey lines, which show the growth in labour productivity, basically at the end of that period from 91 to 2014, come out pretty similar. There's a very slight advantage to Australia over that period, but basically there's been no real change over that period from 1991 to 2014 in productivity growth between the two countries. And there's a story as to why living standards have gone up, but the productivity's remained the same, but that's a topic of a paper that I've got coming out in due course. So that means that if we change from growth rates to looking at levels, that Australia is still quite a long way away from the global frontier. So we're sitting, you know, somewhere between 75 to 80% of the productivity levels of the United States. And if you want to think about that in a way which is actually pretty stark, you can measure it the lag in years. So Australia's labour productivity, measured in US purchasing power parity, dollars per hour, in 2014 was the same as the United States level in 1999. So it's a 15-year gap between Australia and the United States in terms of that level. Now, there's a bunch of reasons why it's unlikely that Australia will ever, could ever get to 100% of the US level, which is to do with the size of our market and the distance from global markets. But I would contend that you want to be in that kind of period that we saw in the 1990s, where it was edging up instead of plateauing. And so I think that's something that we need to be focusing on. So how might you go about thinking about that? So this is a diagram that I've taken from a terrific report that the OECD published last year called The Future of Productivity, and these are not real countries, these are just stylized examples, but I want you to think about country A at the top as representing the United States, and country Australia is probably a bit of an amalgam of country B and country C. That is that we do have some companies, and I'd think of examples like Rio Tinto and BHP, of companies that are really at or very close to the global frontier, but they're pretty rare. So we lag behind the United States, and so as a policy objective, what we want to do is we want to shift our average up. So if you think about country B, we want to be able to move that distribution to the right so it gets closer to country A. And there are four different ways that you can think about doing that. So one is that you want the firms that perform the best in Australia to perform even better so they get closer to the global frontier. And an example of a government program that's designed to kind of help facilitate that is the cooperative research centres. You might want to raise the productivity of all businesses, if that can be done, by encouraging them to innovate more, and that would shift the whole distribution to the right. And if you think about an example, there would be something like the Research and Development Tax Incentive, which is a demand-based entitlement program that's open to all businesses to access. A third thing you might want to do is you might want to assist businesses that aren't performing so well to improve their performance. And there's a whole bunch of ways in which you'd hope businesses would do that themselves. The department makes a modest kind of investment in this area through things like the Entrepreneurs Program, where business advisors go into businesses and help them draw up a strategic plan as to how they're going to take their business forward. And if that program's working well, it should be lifting the performance of those businesses. And then the final area, which is really fundamentally important, is around competition policy driving out underperformers. One of the main ways in which we boost productivity is in that classic kind of Schumpeterian sense of new businesses who are coming in, who defeat entrenched or incumbent businesses because they're smarter, more nimble, more adaptable, or they've got better ideas about ways of doing things, and they force those businesses to go out of competition. And that's the way it is. And in Australia, in any given year, there are 250,000 businesses that start, roughly, and 250,000 that go out of business. So we do have a very healthy level of dynamism in the economy. So that's just setting up how we're going to think about this. Now, what evidence do we have on what works? So about 3 years ago, my department entered into a funding partnership with the Australian Bureau of Statistics to take information that the bureaus had for a number of years, a decade or more, on company tax records and the quarterly business activity statement, which the Bureau was using for the purposes of validating the national accounts, and to turn that information into a micro data set. So what it does is it tracks the financial performance of every business in Australia from the time that the GST was introduced and the Australian business number was introduced, from 2000 through to, pardon me, through to the present day. So we're using up to 2014-15 data at the moment. So there's 7 million odd businesses in this data set. There's about 2.1 million businesses in Australia that are active in the sense that they're remitting GST at the moment. And so we've got this able to work with this data, and the other virtue of it, which would have been talked about in the previous session, which I missed, that Mark and others were talking at, is you can integrate that data with any other business data set that is organised by Australian business number. And we've done some of that, and you can do some really cool things. Here's five cool things that we've done with this data. Who innovates and what's the payoff? Who creates jobs? Which types of businesses create jobs and which destroy jobs? What's the payoff to investing in R&D? What do we know about the association between businesses that export and their performance? And how important are so-called gazelles, which is a term that's commonly used when we're talking about businesses that are high-growth firms? At the moment, the way in which we work with this data, just to kind of deal with any issues that people might have about kind of privacy and confidentiality, is my staff go and work in the offices of the Bureau of Statistics and are covered by all of the Bureau's regulations and procedures around that, and including that none of the output that they produce can be used until it's been vetted through a process which ensures that it doesn't compromise anything to do with the privacy and confidentiality of the information. Okay. This is some survey data. The Bureau runs something called the Business Characteristics Survey every year, and every 2 years, alternate years, They do a deep dive on innovation in this survey, and this is just some standard survey results that the ABS published early this year, of which, as you'd expect, larger businesses are more innovative, and that's kind of so what. People do ask this, so just to be clear, the definition that the ABS uses for the purposes of doing this comes from something called the Oslo Manual. Oslo is where a bunch of OECD officials sat down and worked up this definition in the 1990s, and it's now in its fourth iteration. The definition of an innovation-active business is one that has introduced a new or significantly improved good or service, operational process, organisational managerial process, or marketing method. I'm always puzzled why it's not 100%, but there you are. I'm going to make one quick aside here. We published a couple of hours ago, I guess you'd call it a product, it's not a report, called the Industry Monitor. It's the third time we've published this. It has a whole bunch of data in there on things to do with the macroeconomy, with industry, innovation, science, resources, and business. It's all data that's sitting up in the cloud. We've used a tool called Microsoft Power BI to build this, and you can play around and shape the data, selecting different industries, different time periods, and do lots of interesting things according to whatever you're interested in doing. So get online and play with it, and that's the end of the any ad. Right. This is a cross-tabulation rather than anything sophisticated. I'm going to run through these things reasonably quickly, but it's really just to give you a flavour of what we know. So when this survey's been done in the past, the one that I just mentioned, the business characteristics survey, the owners were asked, you know, did this actually improve your business? Did it lead to more sales or more profits or more employment? And they always say yes. And I go, well, you know, what do we really know? But now, having integrated that data into Blade, what we see is there's a very strong association between businesses that are constantly innovating and how well they perform. So businesses that are innovating 1 year but not subsequently, and so we can do this because we've linked all this data up over time, so you can identify the serial or constant innovators and separately from those that do it as a one-off. And you do see here a remarkable strong association that the payoff is to businesses that innovate constantly as opposed to those that are doing it as a one-off. This comes from the first paper that a group of my staff worked on a couple of years ago. So this is the first output from the Blade research, and it was very interesting. It does confirm what's found in other OECD countries, which is that it's young small businesses that are responsible for most job growth in the economy. Now, this is sensitive to the time period in which you do the analysis. This period here, 2006 to 2011, there was a small event in the middle of that called the global financial crisis, where there was a big spike in unemployment and indeed a big spike in business closures. And so some of the what you're seeing there is driven by that. But nonetheless, it is broadly true across OECD countries at different time periods that it is new businesses that are responsible for generating most job growth. This is a paper that's in progress and will be published in the Innovation System Report, which is coming out, due to come out in September. And it looks at the association between expenditure on R&D and the return on that R&D and the rate of growth of these businesses. Now, this is some fancy econometrics that is involved here using quantile regressions, and I'm not going to explain it, partly because you don't need to know and partly because I can't guarantee that I'll be able to explain it adequately. But what we observe is that there's a positive rate of return on average to investing in R&D. But as you'd expect, that's not consistent across the breadth of firms. Some firms actually don't make a return. They make a loss. The projects don't pay off. But at the top end, they pay off big time. And that's something... This is novel, at least for Australia. This is replicating a study that's been done elsewhere. A paper that we published earlier this year looks at the association between businesses that export and how well they perform relative to businesses that don't. Again, there's some fancy econometrics in this which control for a bunch of variables that you'd expect would be associated with whether a business is more likely to export versus those that don't. And once you build in all those controls, you see that the exporting businesses plainly outperform the businesses that don't export. They employ more people, they pay higher wages, they have higher levels of productivity, they invest more, they're more successful. There's a nice write-up of that, and I've got to thank various folk who managed to persuade Jacob Grieber in the Financial Review. I shouldn't be talking about the Financial Review, should I? At an event sponsored by The Australian, but we got a page 3 article in The Australian Financial Review, and Jacob Grieber said this was the strongest advocacy of free trade that had been in work done by a government department for a couple of decades, which I thought was nice. This is a little bit back to the earlier chart on job creation. Again, this is work that's forthcoming. This was work that we published last year, but there's our innovation system report, which we're publishing in September, is going to have its theme around high-growth firms. The astonishing thing, so this uses an OECD definition of high-growth firms, which is businesses that grow by 20% a year, 3 years running. And the amazing thing that you see here is that those businesses account for more than 100% of all job growth and more than 100% of additions to economic activity. So that's why there's a lot of interest in trying to identify what it is about these businesses that makes them so successful, and how do we harness that. So to finish, I've had my wrap-up. Thank you. Our productivity performance has plateaued relative to the frontier. Taking the US as a frontier, we're sitting around that 75 to 80%, not improving. There are very large payoffs to businesses that persistently innovate, that increase their R&D intensity, that compete in international markets. There's an interesting research agenda around high-growth firms and trying to understand their attributes, and we'll be making an initial attempt at explaining some of that. And then that leads into, I think, some fairly reasonable and standard kind of policy prescriptions around the kind of settings that you would want to encourage the entry and scale-up of high-growth firms. Access to capital, promoting innovation networks, a high-quality skilled workforce, and competition policy and regulation policy that is not biased towards incumbents. You want to be able to encourage new entrants. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark. We'll keep going with the presentations, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Paul Jensen. Professor Jensen is the Deputy Dean, Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Melbourne. Professor Jensen is a recognised scholar internationally and an important contributor to Australian policy debates. He is Research Fellow of the Intellectual Property Research Institute of Australia and the Oxford Intellectual Property Research Centre at Oxford University. Please welcome Professor Paul Jensen. Thanks.
set up. Hang on. Can I get a little bit of help? Is that? So thanks, Dee, for that introduction, and thanks to Mark. I should point out too, while we're just getting set up, that I think it's fair to say that innovation policy lags behind other areas of economic policy, like health and education and labour economics. But in the last 5 years since Mark and his team at the department have been established, things have really changed. And so a lot of the rigour and serious evaluation of programs that we see in other areas of economic policy have started emerging in innovation policy, and I think that's a credit to Mark and his team. So we did talk before the presentations and look at ways in which we can do something that's quite complementary to each other. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about science-based innovation. So that's the area that I'm most interested in at the moment. So it means I'll be focusing a little bit more on patents and technological invention rather than broad-scale innovation per se. But as I said, that's just partly because that's where my current research interests lie. So what am I actually going to talk about today? So just to give you a brief outline of the talk, I'm going to start off by giving a fairly optimistic view, I think, in terms of the innovation in Australia. So I think it's customary to try and argue that we have an innovation problem in Australia, and I think it's probably less serious than most analysts seem to think, and I'll give you some ideas about why I think that's the case. So I'll give you some specific reasons for my optimism. I'll then talk a little bit about the suite of current policy settings that were introduced primarily with a flurry of activity around the time that the Turnbull government came to power. I'll give a brief overview of them. And I'll also talk about a couple of specific areas of policy improvements that I think we can work on. So although I have been cautiously optimistic about the innovation landscape at the moment, there are a couple of areas where I think we're really languishing, and I think we could do a lot better. And I've got some fairly provocative ideas about things we might do. And it won't be talking about quantile regressions or anything fancy like that. It's far more sweeping and provocative statements than empirical evidence on that. So as I said, the focus of the talk is really going to be on the science base. It's certainly not the case that that's the only type of innovation that matters. And in terms of looking at productivity growth, it's actually far more important to see diffusion of small innovations rather than big technological innovation. But nevertheless, that's the area that is my primary focus today. So the other speakers, so Mark has already talked a little bit more about specific examples of evidence that he's been working on in the Office of the Chief Economist, and Lisa's going to provide a more context for a broader policy framework, and I'm going to give quite a narrow and focused one on this science-based innovation. So, is there an innovation problem in Australia? Well, it's very much the case that the received wisdom is that Australia's good at generating ideas. We've got lots of good education, lots of good skills, but we're really bad at trying to commercialise those ideas. And the problem that I have with that is that as I travel around the world and speak at different conferences and meet lots of people from Germany and Japan and America and do all these things, they say exactly the same things about themselves. And so it's really got me thinking that, there is a sense in which we all tend to, I think, for some systematic reason, underappreciate how good we are at commercialising. And, you know, in many of those countries, you actually see the same sorts of sentiments and arguments being put forward that we do in Australia. And so I actually think there's some reasons why we can be pretty optimistic about who we are and what we do in the innovation space. And I want to focus on one particular issue, and that's this idea of university-industry collaboration. Because it's one area that we talk about a lot. There's a lot of policy activity in that space. There's a lot of concern about the relationships between universities and industry in Australia in terms of creating and diffusing technology. And while I still think there is lots of cause for concern there, I don't think it's as bad as people suggest. And I think it's time to sort of revisit that particular suite of programs around university-industry collaboration and think about them more carefully. So what I'm going to present here is just some interesting stats. So what happened was about 5 years ago or 6 years ago, the OECD published this league table. The league table out of the 32 countries that were listed, or 30 or 32 countries that were listed in the OECD, showed that Australia languished right at the very bottom when it came to university-industry relations. Somehow, that one piece of evidence got bandied about and very, very quickly became a fact. So everybody started saying, oh, Australia's terrible at commercialising. There's just no connective tissue between universities and industries. It's awful. And that really alarmed me, because not only did it come at a time when there was very little rationale for understanding why you want university-industry collaboration, but we already decided we were really bad at it. So, interestingly, some work came out from IP Australia fairly recently, which took a very different view at trying to understand where we are in the international landscape when it comes to university-industry collaboration, and find a completely different result. This is certainly not to say that the IP Australia data is the the be-all and end-all when it comes to understanding this. It's actually a very complex issue, and there's lots of tendrils and things that we need to understand. And, you know, if you were to look at that table and see who the top countries, Portugal and places like that, I don't think that they're the exemplars of necessarily of university-industry collaboration. But my point is just to show that if you cut the data in different ways, you can come up with very different facts. And I think we need to be more careful about thinking about why it is we actually want to promote university-industry collaboration, what's the underlying rationale for it. And I think it has to be to try and think carefully about changes in the types of questions that get asked in universities, and to think about the speed with which the creation of new ideas flow into practice, get translated into practice, that process of commercialising and becoming genuine innovations. And they're things we can actually empirically test. You know, how does the nature of these relationships actually change the types of questions that get asked and the implementation of those ideas, the commercialisation of them? And moreover, when it comes to this idea of there being a league table of university-industry collaboration, it's not clear to me why you would want to, or that you'd necessarily want to be number one in that league table. It's really not. So it's not like other league tables where it's unambiguously the case that you would like to be at number one. This is one of those areas where there are serious costs associated with being highly ranked. And so what do I mean by that? Well, if you think about the fact that to do more university-industry collaboration or more applied research, you've got to be doing less of something else, you can see there's going to be a huge opportunity cost associated with doing that. And so, you know, if we're going to do more or better university-industry collaboration, then we're probably going to be doing less basic research. And I think, you know, that's something we as economists know very little about. The optimal mix of pure and applied research is something we know very little about. And I think without understanding that, you don't know whether it's optimal for you to be number 13 or number 2 in that league table. So I think, you know, we sort of got seduced by the idea of there's a league table and it's easy to measure and we're doing badly and we've got to do better, without actually thinking about what the data means and how to interpret it and how to think more carefully about the underlying rationale for that sort of collaboration in the first place. So again, if you were to look at different data, and in fact there's a very interesting piece of work that's come out of INSEAD in Europe and Cornell in America, and including WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, who have created a new global innovation index. Now, I've spent a fair bit of time working on indexes myself, and I know that they're quite problematic. They're very difficult to do in a credible way. But this one's actually pretty good. And if you look at that, we perform very well. Out of a long list of countries, I think it's roughly 140 or 150 countries that are on there, we're about 17th overall in terms of innovation. So there's certainly some areas for improvement. If you were to take a close look at the different components of that particular index, you'd find there are areas where we perform quite poorly, and you could imagine we could do better. But nevertheless, overall, on aggregate, we're doing reasonably well there. The other point that I'd make in terms of optimism is that the number, if you just look at the number of successful Australian startups around the place, they're really becoming very prevalent, and they're quite big international players. So companies like Kaggle and Atlassian and Airtasker that are created by and large in Sydney and Melbourne are doing very well internationally. And I think we're now starting to see a new culture of entrepreneurship emerging, which is creating quite a healthy ecosystem. So it was unheard of for places, research-intensive universities like Melbourne, to be focusing on the idea of creating new entrepreneurship programs when I first started working at the university, 10 or 15 years ago. And now they're embracing it with vigour. So there's a brand new Institute for Entrepreneurship that's got master's degrees, and we've got very sophisticated accelerator programs that are now in the sort of fifth or sixth year of operation that are producing companies that are getting, young companies that are getting $250,000 of venture capital funds from Silicon Valley and the like. So, even big research-intensive institutions are starting to embrace this idea that entrepreneurship can be taught. Maybe not the entrepreneurial spirit, maybe that's predetermined, but there are lots of things that go on around entrepreneurship in terms of understanding venture capital systems and financing and risk evaluations and intellectual property as well, that can actually be taught and are important for successful business ventures. And finally, I'd say that the change in the data infrastructure and access that's occurred in this space in the last few years has been mind-boggling. And as I said, Mark has really been at the forefront of that. But there's a lot of support within Prime Minister and Cabinet, with now, believe it or not, within the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and within lots of Commonwealth and state government agencies, you're seeing much greater preparedness to both make existing data sets available, to link them to other existing administrative data sets, and to make them available to the public and analysts. And I think that augurs well for not just companies that want to be able to access that data in order to be able to innovate and launch onto the world markets, but also for analysts who want to do serious evaluation of innovation programs. Okay, so in terms of the National Innovation and Science Agenda that was launched by Malcolm Turnbull around the time of the last conference, I believe, the last conference in November 2015, there were four main pillars, just to reflect on them very quickly: culture and capital, collaboration, talent skills, and data access. So I've touched on a few of those elements already. But more specifically, if you were to look at the programs, and it's a non-exhaustive list, there's lots of other stuff that's going on, but a couple of the big areas. One is the greater emphasis on impact in university research. So the government is very much following the UK here and trying to promote the idea that university research and scientists should care more about the impact of their work. And when I say impact here, I mean impact outside of the academy. So it's not about publications and citations. It's about impact on society. Secondly, there's a huge chunk of money that was put forward via the Biomedical Translation Fund to look at ways in which we can better commercialise biomedical research. There was the Data 61 initiative, which looked at improving the quality of data analytics and data analytics training for people. And finally, opportunities for women in STEM. So the idea that we need to increase participation rates, female participation rates, which I think is slowly starting to happen. Believe it or not, at the University of Melbourne a couple of years ago, we had the mathematics and statistics department actually advertising positions for women only. So they got special dispensation to be able to advertise for that and had a very successful round of hiring in the maths and stats area. And I think that others are following suit. All right. So I talked about some provocative statements about ways in which we can, or areas in which we might be able to see some policy improvements. And, you know, it should be pretty clear that from my previous comments that one of my particular bugbears relates to university-industry collaboration, which I think is it's a very important area, but it's one still a lot of work has to be done on it. So although there have been some changes that have been put forward, they're yet to have any serious bite within the academic community. I mean, there are islands, if you like, of excellence when it comes to impact in universities, the Melbourne Institute probably being one in the social sciences space, but most academics just aren't interested. And until there's a more fundamental change in the set of incentives that we provide and rewards that we provide for academics, I don't think you're actually going to see much movement there. Secondly, I'd say that, you know, this idea, we seem to think that, you know, successful university industry relationships and connective tissue is manna from heaven that's somehow going to fall from the sky and we'll all be able to devour that. But the reality is that if you look in Japan and Germany and places like that, they have dedicated PhD programs that are not designed to try and train individuals to become academics. They train people to go into industry. So how do these long-term relationships build up between big labs in universities and R&D labs in BMW or in Tesla Corp or wherever? They happen because people get trained at universities and then move into industry and take those ideas or some of those ideas with them, develop them further and go off and create great new innovative products. But those connections actually stay. That's how they're formed. They don't just drop from the sky. And until we understand about the creation of those networks, we won't be able to realise much in this space. And typically in the US, you find that academics only have 9-month salaries. I'm not suggesting by any means that we introduce something like that in Australia. There'd be a riot on your hands, I think. But what happens with these 9-month salaries is that for the other 3 months, they go and look for jobs in industry. So that's one way in which there's serious commitment on both sides with regard to the sharing of knowledge and the joint formation of interesting research and innovation puzzles to work on. And finally, I'll just say too that, you know, although there has been some work done in the past in trying to evaluate things like the CRCs, we really need a wholesale evaluation of that whole suite of programs. I don't think there's much evidence that they're working effectively, and we don't know much about the specific mechanisms that are successful and which ones aren't, and I'd really like to see much more work done in that space. I've only got a couple of minutes left, and this is my second last slide. The other area I wanted to focus on was on skills and capabilities. So in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been some really influential papers in top economics journals looking at the effect of global mobility on innovation outcomes. Doesn't matter whether you're looking at inventors or scientists or researchers or engineers, people have found creative ways using completely different data sets to look at what happens when you're mobile. And the outcome is really clear. There's a big premium for innovation. And I've actually started a new program of work with WIPO, which is looking at international mobility of inventors, and we're hoping to be able to contribute something to that space in the next year or two. So in that light, the recent restrictions that on mobility that the government has introduced, I think are completely short-sighted. I think it's exactly the wrong thing that we should be doing at this time when you've got phenomena like Brexit and some of the changes that, that President Trump has introduced. Australia should be taking advantage of that. They should be trying to attract that global talent to Australia in order to drive innovation outcomes. I should say, too, that universities, amongst others, have been very vocal in their opposition, and there has been a little bit of change at the margin with regard to the government's position on that. Okay, in conclusion, I'd say, I've presented some cautious reasons for optimism about Australia's innovation performance. You know, for the first time in the 15 years that I've been working in that space, I feel like governments, universities and industry are talking from the same hymn page, which is fantastic. There's still a lot of work to do. I hope that all of the good work that that the current government has done in that space isn't going to fall over if they don't win the next election. I think it needs a longer-term concerted program of work in that space, so let's hope that happens. And finally, just to say that I'm really excited about the prospects for improved data access and the hope that that's going to lead to much more sophisticated and rigorous analysis of the suite of innovation programs that we have in Australia. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I'm actually pleased that we've got a good gender balance on the panel here. Our final speaker today is Ms. Lisa Cropp. Lisa is the Chief Economist for the Business Council of Australia. Lisa came to the Business Council from the Productivity Commission, where she most recently served as First Assistant Commissioner and Principal Advisor Research. Prior to joining the Productivity Commission, Lisa was a research fellow at Monash University, as well as holding ministerial advisory positions. I'd like to welcome Lisa to the stage.
I don't have any slides.
Good.
Sorry. Thank you. As Paul flagged, I sort of intend to take a bit of a broader policy contextual approach to this, sort of leveraging off the teaser or the promo for this session, which posed the question whether the focus on support for entrepreneurs, startups, researchers and the CSIRO is too narrow. To answer this, I think we've got a good place to start is to ask what are we trying to achieve? And as Mark said, the objective has to be to increase productivity. At the end of the day, we want innovation to translate to a net increase in economic value. Productivity growth, and I don't have to remind you of this, is that, you know, that's the main driver of real per capita income growth over time, and that in turn underpins living standards. And if you look at Australia, any, you know, labour productivity in particular has, in Australia has been the main driver of income growth over the past decades. I think, though, sometimes we think there's a magic source of innovation and productivity growth. So often there's a tendency, I think, to think of an innovation sector as something discrete, separate from the rest of the economy. That, and there are sort of, there's a scientific stream, and I think Paul alluded to this, but where I want to get to is that often the productivity is just a day-to-day grunt thing within firms, and it's just little steps all the time. But the narrow interpretation may stem from a narrow interpretation of productivity growth itself, what we call multi-factor productivity, which is just the residual unexplained GDP growth. It's what we don't understand, if you like. But it's also the growth we kind of get for free. There's a huge literature devoted to identifying what that source is, whether it's technical change, disembodied technical change, that is the technical change that's not embodied in capital, learning spillovers, and it goes on and on. And the view is if you can somehow generate more of this technical know-how, knowledge, productivity will rise. But it's a bit like the search for the Holy Grail. It's not that simple. There's no magic source that can be turned on like a tap. Moreover, around the world, you've got plenty of freely available technical know-how, knowledge, but many countries remain extremely poor. There has to be more to it. So I think while technology and knowledge are critical parts of the productivity story, they must somehow translate to the efficient delivery of more goods and services that people want. We need to understand what inhibits and encourages the creation and diffusion of new ideas, know-how and technologies within and across countries. At the end of the day, more efficient production comes from decisions made by people in enterprises all over the economy. So productivity growth is about producing things better and innovating to produce more, better quality or new products using the same or fewer inputs. I'm a big fan of Arnold Harberger, and he's written some fantastic papers on growth and productivity. And he does sort of rearrange the growth equations and made the pragmatic, even prosaic, insight that productivity growth is anything that leads to real cost reductions. Doesn't sound as sort of magic and glamorous as some of the other things, but that's real cost reductions. You use less resources, which frees up resources to go somewhere else. And he also said that this reinterpretation makes it clearer that enterprise innovation can come in 1,001 ways. It may well involve invention, major technical change, and knowledge transfer, but it also comes from learning by doing and reorganising processes and people within enterprises. It's just day-to-day slog. So, and moreover, reinterpreted in that way, you can clearly see that no matter how big or small, productivity gains add to real income growth and they add up over time. And they're all worth having. And I think from that, the lesson is that if you have policies that favour one form or source of innovation over another, leaving aside whether there's maybe a market failure and there's some reason for intervention, you can overlook or even discourage important alternative sources of productivity growth. Which firms innovate? Now, Mark's gone through that and the work that's being done is really interesting. But I think there is a perception that productivity growth only comes from small firms and startups. Yet recent OECD research suggests that firms pushing the frontier are large. They're still young, but very large multinationals. Productivity Commission did a review into entry and exit of firms and found that a lot of new small firms aren't innovators, and that's not really surprising given the sort of the lot of services firms, etc. There's probably not much scope to figure out how to, the technology of a haircut, even though you can be quite creative, I guess. ABS data, and Mark's also shown this, that it's large Australian businesses that are a lot more likely to innovate than smaller ones. And there's also pretty consistent international evidence that larger manufacturing enterprises generally have significantly higher productivity levels than smaller ones. Cottage industries don't necessarily work in all sectors. This is not to say that innovation and market entry by small firms is not important for productivity growth. It clearly is. But we shouldn't put all our policy eggs into that basket. Even worse, policies should not undermine larger businesses and discourage the efficient growth of younger firms. There's been a really interesting paper just last year or so by, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Garrahan et al. There's also Van Reenen is an author. They find a huge economic cost, more than 3% of GDP, resulting from French labour laws, because by exempting smaller firms, they're effectively taxing large and successful firms. In Australia, the work hasn't been done, but we do know that smaller businesses are often either exempt from or pay lower rates of payroll tax, for example, or company tax now. There's going to be a 5 percentage point differential in a few years. This will have a huge sort of put a huge ceiling, if you like, on efficient growth of firms. And so are we, by those policies, impeding our so-called gazelles? I think all this boils down to a need for a broad, holistic approach to improving productivity built on an understanding of what fundamentally drives it. Efforts to promote invention and innovation, worthy as they may be, may not count for much if businesses have little incentive or capability to invest in or adopt new technologies. And this comes perhaps the most critical thing, that institutions and the rules of the game are crucial. The environment in which businesses operate, the incentives provided by markets, taxes, subsidies and regulations, legal and political institutions, are just perhaps the main game. A vital role for government, perhaps its most important role, is to ensure that institutional and legal settings, the rules of the game, create the right, or at least do not blunt or destroy, incentives and price signals for firms to make efficient decisions. Putting it bluntly, rent-seeking or lawless, corrupt societies are not productive ones. In particular, I'm not suggesting that's Australia. If you look around the world, Australia's institutions are generally pretty good. but there are some little re-emerging protectionist tendencies, which I think we have to be very, very aware of and ready to push back on. Because we know that open competitive markets are fundamental to encouraging firms to innovate and reduce costs and to pass on those cost reductions as lower prices. And we know that trade promotes productivity growth through access to imported know-how as well as competitive pressures that force local producers to improve their efficiency, and that accords with the evidence that Mark's shown, that it's exporters that are more innovative, et cetera, and that sort of makes it common sense that they have to do that to stay in business. Australia reduced its tariff barriers unilaterally decades ago, recognising that the costs of protection are largely borne by us, not foreigners, but protectionist pressures just lie dormant and never die. And Australia should not only take a lead in international forums in resisting them, but at home we have to also resist pressures that morph into other channels, such as local content requirements. Foreign investment is also another critical transmission mechanism for new technology, processes and know-how. And here, we're still quite open to foreign investment. I mean, I'm talking direct foreign investment here. But, you know, for example, in the agricultural sector, the threshold have been lowered considerably. And that's one sector where we do need investment and productivity growth. Another area which Mark mentioned is competition policy. And I guess I think this is an area where you have to be very careful about the balance. Clearly competition policy is an important tool for preventing abusive market power and ensuring that markets remain competitive. But you can't base your competition policy on an expectation that markets and enterprises operating within them achieve a textbook construct of perfect competition. It doesn't make any sense in the real world, and it's unachievable. Markets are about trade-offs. If we correct every perceived market imperfection, productivity would reduce because we'd completely undermine the dynamic commercial incentives that drive businesses to solve problems in the first place. Again, Mark mentioned the Schumpeterian sort of view and about market entry. That's very important, but Schumpeter also made the point, which is really a story of disequilibrium, not equilibrium, that there's an expectation of a return. And entrepreneurs simply don't jump out of bed in the morning with an expectation of earning a normal rate of return. They need to have an expectation of getting something more. So we have to sort of marry those two. And I think there's been some work done in the US recently, which is trying to, you know, this... It was, you know, whether it was perfect competition or monopoly that drove innovation. Well, it's about having a dynamic. It's about a dynamic process where they expect to get something. Whether they get it or not is another thing. But you have to encourage them to innovate, and it has to be that there's some incentive for them to do it. So in that context, I think where I work, the Business Council, sort of concerned about a growing tendency for regulators to use what could be described as catch-all approaches, because where the regulator says, "Oh well, we'll look at things. You do it, and then we'll look at it and see whether it's okay." Businesses can't operate in that world. They need to exploit commercial opportunities when they arise, make decisions about investments in new technologies. They can't be submitted for pre-approval. Or wait, you know, and they can't say, "Oh, well, we might do that, but we'll have to wait for approval from the regulator." And recent amendments to Section 46 perhaps fall into that, you know, we would say are a worrying example, because for that very reason, they risk stifling business innovation, because whether they get the tick of approval pre or post. I think there's also a suggestion by some that Australian markets are becoming more concentrated, and this might be driving out entry and innovation. But often those claims are based on aggregate metrics such as business revenue to GDP or product price rises relative to the CPI, none of which are really indicators of market power, good indicators of market power, which you can only measure that if you look at actually assess barriers to entry, the degree of exposure to global price competition, and a proper analysis of the scope of the market. If anything, Australia, and this is maybe an area of research, may need to achieve greater economies of scale in some sectors to be a competitive global player. I guess any discussion from somebody from the Business Council without talking about tax would not be complete, but I'll go over it quickly. But the fact is the marginal excess burdens of a number of taxes in Australia are pretty high. Company tax, about 50 cents. Stamp duty, around 70 cents. Probably the personal income tax system hasn't been properly modelled in sense of the highest tax rates. Now, those marginal excess burdens capture the resource allocation impacts, but high tax rates also dull entrepreneurship, innovation and productivity. And the OECD's work on this has found that lower corporate tax rates promote total factor productivity growth of the most dynamic and innovative enterprises. So just, again, reinforcing that incentives matter. Regulation, again, we're not saying you need regulation to align behaviour with social interests, but poorly conceived or badly administered regulations obstruct efficient production choices. And I think all too often regulation is the first resort of policymakers because the costs can be hidden. They're not. If you have to put a tax on, at least you can see who's paying it. And unfortunately, while we've got processes in place to assess these impacts, they often bypassed. The cumulative compliance burden is also an important thing. Even if each regulation is efficient, the cumulative burden can divert management time, effort away from things like innovation and improving productivity. They can also, significant fixed costs of compliance with regulations can deter market entry by new entrants. And indeed, the OECD has found that regulations, including workplace relations, may be hindering diffusion of new technologies across enterprises. One idea of regulatory holidays is often floated to facilitate disruptive business models, so that's sort of promoting entry, but it kind of bells the cat that the regulatory regime is not fit for purpose and should be reconsidered for all business models. The promo to this also talked about human capital, and I think the previous speakers have spoken about that. But sure, I mean, this is an area where business also has an important responsibility, but governments also play a vital role in improving human capital. Does that necessarily mean greater investment? Well, we would say that the current investment could be better, get much better value out of the current investment in human capital in education and in vet and higher education. But it clearly is critical to innovation and productivity, as are other investments in R&D and scientific research, et cetera, as well as in infrastructure. So just to sum up, I think the typical ingredients of innovation policy to support R&D, research, entrepreneurs, et cetera, are very important for promoting innovation and productivity growth and can be targeted to particular linkages, et cetera. But they have to be nested within a much broader policy framework that promotes dynamic market competition and efficiency in enterprises. We need to create both the incentives for innovation and continual improvement by enterprises and the capacity for them to implement it. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa. So what I took away from, you know, some of the key messages here today is that we need to continue to drive cross-industry, academic and a broader ecosystem of collaboration to remain competitive on a global stage. We need to work out how we commercialise, you know, more of our innovation and, by the sounds of it, you know, probably work on the measures of success and what that looks like. We need to continue to utilise and access the emerging data sets and technology to better inform our decision making and to drive, you know, broader and better insights into what we do. And we need to reduce the burden of compliance. So hopefully you found that, you know, diverse and very interesting. I am going to open up to some questions from the audience. If I could ask you to please, you know, raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. And if you could just say your name and where you're from and who you're directing your question to. So lady down the back.
Thanks very much. Hazel Moyer, Australian National University. A quick question to Mark. Your first graphic on the positive association between innovation and sales growth, profit growth, is that controlled for firm size? And a comment, you raised the important issue of regulatory impediments to innovation. One of the most interesting ones I've come across is the idea that anti-compete laws are a massive impediment to innovation. And they are, for example, unconstitutional in California, but they're part of the business regulatory environment in Massachusetts. And that might explain a lot of the difference between the success of Silicon Valley and the lower degree of success of Route 125 or 128 or whatever it's called. And so those are two general things. But then I'd like to ask a broader question to all of you. There's some very dangerous regulation coming along in trade treaties. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has in Chapter 30, I think it is, might not be, might be a different number, it effectively puts into concrete blocks our current abysmally low inventiveness standard in the patent system. It would also require us to change the presumption of a granted patent from a presumption that it's not necessarily inventive to a presumption that it is inventive, which has been shown to be a massive impediment to other innovating firms in the USA. So just a few thoughts on what have been some very interesting papers. Thank you.
All right. So, Hazel, thanks for your questions. On the on that chart with the association between persistence of innovation and financial performance, my recollection is that it does not control for size. The various other charts that I put up were econometric. We'll eventually do that properly. I'm pretty sure that you'll still find a very strong association, notwithstanding the first slide and Lisa's point that it is large businesses that innovate more frequently than smaller businesses. I am going to defer to Paul on patent and trade.
I'm happy to respond to that, Hazel. I think you're exactly right. Both of those provisions are really quite scary. And in fact, in consort, they're really scary because I think the inventive step threshold is way too low. And we still know very little about how it varies from country to country and national patent office to patent office. But that is something we've done quite a lot of work on. And I don't think there's any doubt that it should be raised and across the world. And the idea that you would keep it at its low level and enshrine this presumption of validity is just completely wrong-headed. So I hope that answers your question, or it validates your concerns anyway.
We have a question here.
Mark Wooden, Melbourne Institute. Two questions directed at Mark. Firstly, on that association for innovation and profits, were you able to look at the causation? Does it run from, you implied it ran from innovation to profitability, but could it equally run from profitability to innovation? That's the first question. And the second question, which Lisa implied it might have been answered, maybe I just missed it, but where do these high job growth firms come from? Do they start life as like single entrepreneurs, or do they start life hiring people? And if the latter, how large are they when they start their, you know, 3 or 4 year growth spurt?
So specifically, again, on that particular chart, that's a simple cross-tabulation as far as I know, so there's no proper test of causality there. Some of the other work we've done incorporates various lags, or we've done propensity score matching to kind of identify local average treatment effects when we're measuring some of these associations, but not in that particular one. The second question is that's the fascinating kind of agenda that's opening up is what are the attributes of these firms, and is it possible to identify something around the kind of quality of entrepreneurship which gives rise to this phenomenon? There's some interesting work that's coming out of MIT with Scott Stern and colleagues, which offers some promise there, but I doubt that it's able to lead to anything that's kind of actionable kind of policy advice from governments.
Right, you've got to do this as longitudinal
data, right? Yes,
yes. So you should be able to do this
now. We can identify them retrospectively, of course, and identify their attributes, but as to what gives rise to this phenomena, that's much harder.
Lisa, Paul, you probably have a view on some of those attributes.
Of successful firms.
Mm.
well, I mean, you can surmise it, and I think with Mark, I mean, you look back and see what's happened, but whether that's going to be what
happens
in going forward, and I think there are some, obviously, good management is obviously one, and but yeah, I mean.
Strong
management and good workplace culture and all of these things. But then again, I mean, sometimes I mean in the mining sector would have had a huge explosion, and that was to do with an external event in the sense of prices. I guess that would have been expansion there as well, and innovation.
Right, but I mentioned. Both BHP and Rio, I think it's Australians, particularly those who live in capital cities and don't get out and visit mining companies, don't appreciate just how stunningly innovative and at the leading edge these companies are. So Australia has gone from producing, if we take iron ore as an example, roughly 100 million tonnes of iron ore in about 2000 to 800 million tonnes of iron ore a year now. It's increased its market share. So it's a growing market, but Australia's increased its market share and is the number one exporter in the global seaborne trade for iron ore, and it's doing that at lower real costs than it was doing it in the year 2000. So there's been incredible productivity gains. Partly from investment, but also you can, BHP runs its mining operations remotely from Perth in the Pilbara, several thousand kilometres away, with people sitting around with 16 computers screens in front of them, digitally tracking every single ounce of dirt that's dug up and how it's transferred through to a port. These are very slickly run companies, and there's a lot of patenting activity and a real innovation network that's evolved around data analytics and buying startups in Perth that's enabled all that to happen.
They also collaborate with the university sector.
That's exactly right.
And they're driving, you know, a huge agenda to, you know, use the insights and the data sets that they have to be, you know, far more, you know, predictable. Even in their maintenance and asset optimization areas. Down the front here.
Hi, thanks. Ewan Hannon from the Australian newspaper. I just wanted to ask Paul Jetson a question in relation to when you were talking about the areas for particular improvement. We're talking about the need to improve incentives for academics potentially. I just wondered if you could expand on that and what sort of thoughts and how that would work potentially to improve more collaboration.
Yeah, so the sort of things I have in mind, so obviously, you know, academics care about becoming professors. And it's currently, it's very difficult to make your way through to being a full professor if you have a purely an engagement focus and less emphasis on research and teaching. So, you know, you think about the sort of outputs that we create, and it's really about getting the balance and mix of those right. So I think, so some of it's about promotion. Some of it's about... career channels more broadly. So, I mean, the University of Melbourne's been fairly assertive in this space. So they've now got enterprise professors, so people who are sort of practitioner-focused who don't have research pedigrees per se. They might have PhDs, but even that's not necessary. And so creating new ways in which we can try and facilitate greater and deeper relationships between university and industry. And, yeah, so that's a kind of flavour of the sort of things I'm thinking about.
Matthew Mercer from the Treasury. So my question's open to all the panel, but it's based on something Paul and Mark, you both mentioned in your presentations. Paul, you mentioned one reason for optimism was increased access to data. And in one of your slides, you had the Blade data set, and in fact, a lot of the work being done by Department of Industries using the Blade data set. So certainly one thing I've heard, and I don't really have a good ear to the ground on this, is in Australia, perhaps there's a bit more of a cultural opposition, I suppose, to this movement towards open data and these big data sets. Which can potentially drive innovation both in government service delivery and in fact, private sector service delivery. I just would be interested in the panels, I suppose, feeling which way is the pendulum sort of swinging in Australia? Is it moving more towards acceptance of open data, or is it, in fact, a bit more culturally entrenched that privacy concerns are going to sort of inhibit this in the future?
So I would simply refer people in the audience, if they haven't already done so, to look at the you always want to look at the executive summary from a Productivity Commission report. You never want to read the reports because they're 800 pages long. So the recently released report by the Productivity Commission on data availability and use is a real clarion call for Commonwealth and state governments and indeed the private sector as to how Australia might really leverage off the opportunities that are available from making data available. But, I mean, you know, the Australian government's made the geocoded national address file freely available for people to use, and that's being embedded in all sorts of apps that people are developing. I think there's all sorts of opportunities that can be taken here, and the PC report sets out a very considered framework for how legislative framework for how that might be done. The government's due at some stage soon to announce its response as to how it's going to take that particular report forward. I'll leave it there. The microphone's right here. All right, I'm finished anyhow.
Can I just add to that? Because there's privately generated data generated within private companies and by government, obviously, and companies are increasingly seeing data as basically that's their huge part of their wealth, if you like, their commercial wealth. And so the Productivity Commission report treads a very interesting area about to what extent you make companies make their data available, and that's going to have implications for their investment in data, and what they see as part of their business model. So public data, the choice is already, you know, decision's been made. This is a public good, if you like. There are still issues around privacy, etc., which have to be negotiated. But there is this tension about how you deal with that, and do you sort of kill the golden goose if you sort of tell companies you've got to make it all available, even leaving aside privacy issues, because they see being able to access that data as generating a part of their business model. It's increasingly becoming their business model is the data, and almost the stuff they produce is kind of on the side. And so we're advocating for as much as market approaches. And if somebody wants to buy if somebody wants access to the data, well, maybe it's a commercial transaction. Then, if you can look after the privacy implications. And so I think it's still very much. I don't think anybody understands the implications of all of this yet. But you hear just extraordinary how companies can monitor use of their products, etc., by their customers and. It's just extraordinary.
And I think we'll see more of that as you know, technology and advances in technology with, you know, things like blockchain and ecosystems, whether they're public, whether they're private, global standards on how they operate. So I think it's not an either-or. Paul, anything you want to add to that?
I would just echo Mark's comments, really, and just say that at least in the public domain, the government domain, I've been really surprised at how quickly the pendulum has shifted. So I think there are still towards data access and openness. And I think there are still pockets of resistance, but I think they're largely being overcome, and I think they'll probably be swept up in the tide as well, and we'll find ways of managing privacy issues because there are serious concerns around that, there's no doubt, but I think that they will be managed rather than being used as a vehicle for blocking openness to data.
All right, any further questions? If not, I'd like to thank Lisa, Paul and Mark for their contribution this afternoon. Thank you very much.